First of all, I'd like to thank Osamach and Hala for this opportunity to study and, as you heard, to teach you how to speak English correctly. We're talking this evening about the question of direction in life and finding the fulfillment, the purpose of life, reaching the correct destination. Well, Gottlieb spoke about the problem of pleasure, and I'd like to speak a little bit about the problem of beauty. You know, we live in a world with many challenges. Bringing up children, families, in a world with tremendous moral challenges. One of the real problems we face is the problem of sensual beauty and the way it's presented in the world. Perhaps even the major challenge. And today there's no escaping it. It's not only... It drives inward. You don't have to go out and look for it in many ways. What's the Torah approach to this issue? How do we see beauty, woman's beauty? And I think that if you think through the subject, you look through Torah sources, and you look at the representation of this value in the world around us, I think you see tremendous conflict. First of all, in the world around us, it doesn't really need much working out. You see a tremendous conflict. You see that on the one hand, woman's beauty is presented as something that is tremendously fallen, presented in a very, very low and sensual, mindless and animal fashion. There's a conflict between seeing beauty for its inner content and seeing only the shell. You see, the society that we live in, you know, no matter how religious you consider yourself, you know that if you go to the art galleries of the world, you see things that are, you see people depicted in ways that are supposed to be beautiful. People admire the beauty of those paintings. If the subjects of some of those paintings had to walk down the street dressed that way or not dressed that way, you know, I presume they'd rather die than be seen that way. I mean, I hope so. And yet, that is depicted as beauty. And in some strange way, there must be a source of that. It's confused, and yet there must be some truth in it. And after all, isn't the body meant to be beautiful? Then why are we ashamed when we expose our bodies? Let's try and think through the subject together. I think it's a fundamental issue. And I think the confusion that we experience in this generation makes it essential to study it and know it in depth. I think that if you look through Torah sources, you see two opposite directions on this subject. On the one hand, you see that external beauty, physical beauty, sensual beauty is presented as something very worthy. For example, there are occasions in Torah where it's made apparent that somebody is beautiful. The Gemara says, for example, we have many sources that talk about Sarah Imena's beauty, Sarah, the wife of Abraham, Avraham Avinu. And her beauty was a throwback to the beauty of earlier generations, which was an echo of the beauty of Eve, Chava, who was exquisitely beautiful. And there's no question that when the Torah talks about Sarah's beauty, it means a sensual beauty. We're not talking about a sort of a spiritual aura. We're talking about something very, very earthy and sensual. How do we know that? Because the Egyptians, that's what you were about to say, right? The Egyptians were ready to kill for her. The Egyptians were not into the spiritual. Egypt was the most depraved place on earth. And the Egyptians were ready to kill for that sort of beauty. And therefore she must have been exquisitely beautiful in a conventional sense, in an Egyptian sense. And there are many questions here. One question is, why would the Torah tell us that? I mean, the Torah is a spiritual document. It's a document of teaching, of how to be elevated and how to be spiritual. Why is it important that she was a beautiful woman? And if the Torah says it, it must mean not only that it's important, but it must be central. It must be essential. There are many occasions in Torah where beauty is depicted as essential. Not only women. Yosef, for example, Joseph, the Torah describes as having the kind of beauty that's usually used in the ascription to women. And again, the question is, why is it important? The Midrashim tell us that he was exquisitely beautiful. He was so unbelievably beautiful that women couldn't take their eyes off him. The Midrash says that if the Egyptian women were peeling, you know, vegetables, when he walked past, they'd peel their fingers. He was so exquisitely beautiful. And again, the question is, why is that important? In later generations, you find that there were Tanoim of extreme beauty. You find even down to the generation of Amoraim, for example. The Gemara says that Yochanan was so exquisitely beautiful that on one occasion when he went to visit a friend of his who was ill and poverty-stricken in a dark house, Yochanan lifted his sleeve and lit the house. The incandescence of his beauty lit the house. The Gemara says they used to put him outside the mikveh, that women on their way home would see, and they wouldn't chas v'shalom see an animal, they would see somebody with such exquisite beauty. So the Torah makes a fuss about beauty. The Gemara says, "Ein isha ela lanoi." One opinion in the Talmud goes, a woman's essence maybe, or essence in marriage, or some essential aspect of a woman is her beauty. So, on the one hand, it's very clear that beauty and physical beauty and a woman's beauty is portrayed as something essential, something very necessary, something beautiful. And the question is why? But more difficult is, we find the opposite as well. The Torah makes it plain that physical beauty is problematic. Example. The Gemara says that there was a man called Yeshua ben Chananya. He was one of the greatest, maybe the greatest sage of his generation. Tremendous rabbinic authority in the time of the Mishnah. And he was unspeakably ugly. Perhaps even distorted. Very ugly. And on one occasion he met the Caesar's daughter, or the Roman Emperor's daughter, or the governor of Israel, whoever it was, a major Roman authority. He met his daughter, and when she met this rabbi, she said, first thing she said to him was, how can such beautiful wisdom be contained in such an ugly vessel? How could there be such exquisite wisdom in such an ugly vessel? She wasn't even ashamed to ask him about his ugliness. It was so obvious. Interesting, the Talmud says that he was formed by the sounds of Torah. When he was a baby, his mother wheeled his baby carriage into the Beis Medrash, that the sounds of Torah learning should form him. And he grew up with that tremendous ugliness. By the way, it's very interesting that this question is asked by a woman. The one who's bothered by his ugliness is a woman. Because, again, woman is the locus, if you like, of beauty. Even the quality of Bina, which we usually translate, Bina means an understanding, certain type of intuitive or deep understanding. But one of the meanings of Bina that a woman has is the knowledge of how to apply that inner wisdom, how to dispose things. The definition of Bina is Moitzi Dava Mitoich Dava, to take one thing out of it, to extract more from a source, how to dispose and organize things. Women have the sense of being able to organize things. There's a certain talent of the aesthetic. Men can be very organized, but not beautiful, unless they have a womanly quality. If you go to a place where men are organized, for example, I had the experience of being in an army. Spent 2 years in an army. If you visit an army base where there are only men, it's exquisitely organized, but it's deathly. But you let a woman loose for an hour or two, it starts to look like something. They know how to organize things in a certain aesthetic balance. So it's a woman who's looking at this man who's ugly. She knows he's a reputation for tremendous wisdom. And she says, how can such exquisite wisdom be contained in such an ugly vessel? Not only is she a woman, by the way, she's a Roman woman. You know that Rome was the culture of Greece. Rome didn't have its own culture. Rome was the mighty empire that spread Greek philosophy around the world. And Greece, the doctrine of Greece was a beautiful mind and a beautiful body. That's exactly what Greece taught. The Greek games were played naked. The body was exposed. So she comes from the legacy of Greek thought, which teaches that you have, the Latin expression was mens sana per corpore sana, a healthy mind and a healthy body. That the vessel must be beautiful to have a beautiful content. That if the content is beautiful, it demands a beautiful vessel. So she, as a woman with a sense of the aesthetic, and a Roman woman with a sense, the knowledge of healthy minds in healthy bodies, beautiful content in beautiful vessels, she's struck by this rabbi who has tremendous wisdom and tremendous ugliness. So she says to him, how can such beautiful content be in such an ugly vessel? So the Gemara says that he said to her, what does your father keep his wine in? So the girl said, like all, everyone keeps his wine in clay vessels. In those days they kept wine in clay amphora, you know, earthenware, simple earthenware vessels. Vodka? Thanks for that. Thank you. Thank you. She said, my father keeps his wine in the wine cellars in clay vessels. So he said to her, but surely that's not fitting for a king. Surely a king's wine should be in gold and silver vessels. So she went home to the palace and she had her father's wine in the wine cellars transferred from the clay vessels into gold and silver. And when you put alcohol into metal vessels, it goes off, sours. The alcohol leaches out the metal and the reaction causes the wine to go sour. All the wine was destroyed. So when they served the wine at Caesar's table, it was all ruined. He said, what's going on? So she said, the Jew told me to do it. So he called him Shir ben Hananiah and he said to him, what's going on? Shir ben Hananiah said, I showed your daughter that when the vessel has its own importance, it ruins the content. I try to show her that a vessel must be purely a vessel. When the vessel only holds, the content is pure. But when the vessel makes its own contribution and speaks for itself, it ruins the content. There's a clash, a battle between vessels and content. And wine is pure only because it's in a vessel that only holds. A vessel is there to be a vessel and that's all. When the vessel speaks for itself, it ruins the content. This is the opposite message. This is the message, the first message the Torah seems to be giving us, is that a beautiful content must be in a beautiful vessel. And here the Torah is teaching exactly the opposite. By the way, she wasn't satisfied with that answer. She said to him, you telling me that if the vessel is beautiful, it ruins the content, and that's why you need an ugly body? You need to be an ugly man so that your wisdom can be very great? What about your friends, the rabbis whom I know who are extremely good-looking and very wise? Rabbi Yochanan was beautiful. Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol was so beautiful that when the Romans killed him, the daughter of the Caesar at the time begged her father to keep him alive because he was so beautiful for her. And he refused, so she had his face skinned. And she kept the mask of his face to be able to contemplate his beauty. So she said to him, if you're telling me that the vessel must be ugly, and you're wise only because you have an ugly appearance, what about the rabbis who are so wise and so beautiful? And he said to her, I have a son, I have a gemiri tvei. Had they been ugly, they would have been wiser. In other words, despite their good looks, they achieved wisdom. And I had it easy because of my ugliness did not obstruct my wisdom. But what are we learning? We're learning here that the vessel must be broken. So then why does the Torah tell us about Sarah, for example, Sarah Imenu, that she was beautiful? And somehow that's a positive thing? We have a problem, right? Yes? No? Anyone out there? We have a question. What's the resolution of this issue? Are the vessels meant to be beautiful to enhance the content, or must the vessels be ugly to enhance the content? What's the correct approach? What does a woman's beauty mean? Is it to be portrayed and projected? Is it to be hidden? What does this mean? What's the correct approach to this problem? You know, the deep Torah sources say that the world is always lights and vessels, content and vessels. As we call it, lights and vessels. There's a light inside. There's a vessel that contains the light. The two are in potential conflict. They should be in harmony. They're both important. In Tchias HaMesim, in the resurrection of the dead, it means the bodies will be there again. Somehow there needs to be a harmony between the two. Our teaching is not that in the final analysis, in the final generation of history and beyond, there'll be only souls. On the contrary, there'll be bodies again too. Not bodies like we inhabit now, bodies that are spiritualized, but there'll be vessels, always vessels for the lights. In fact, there'll be a meshing and a bonding into oneness of those two dimensions. They both have to be there. The Ramchal says in one place, the body was part of the work, it has to be part of the reward. And when Gemara puts it exquisitely, Gemara says that there was a discussion once between Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, the great author of the Mishnah, codified the Mishnah, and Antoninus, the great Roman emperor, Marcus Aurelius, who was a very great man spiritually. He had discussions. On one occasion, the Roman said to Rebbe, and again, this is a Roman perspective, he said to him, I'll show you how in the next world you can exempt yourself from all judgment. When you die, and God comes to judge you, I'll teach you a way, I'll show you, I'll demonstrate to you that you can exempt yourself from all punishment in the next world. So Rebbe said, no. And he said as follows. After death, when the soul and the body are separated, after all, that's what death is. Death is not a dying of the soul. The soul cannot die. Death means that the soul is distracted, extracted from the body. The body lies passive in the grave. The soul floats in some sense. So when God deals with this separated entity, that's a human being after death, what will happen? Hashem will try to punish the body. And the body will say, God, it wasn't my fault. Hashem, it wasn't me. I'm just an inanimate lump of clay lying in the grave. I'm not capable of doing anything wrong. It was soul's animating power that was the reason that I sinned. So Hashem will punish the soul, God of the soul, and the soul will say, what do you want from me? I'm floating in the air like a bird. Had it not been for the body, I could have done nothing wrong. Each will blame the other, and you'll be exempt from all punishment. Nice try, huh? So Rebbe said to him, I'll show you the correct answer to that question. Listen to this beautiful analogy. You know, an analogy is a vessel for the content. He said, there was once a king who had an orchard of fruit, and he took two guards to guard the fruit. Two men, one of whom was lame and one of whom was blind. And the king ordered these two men to guard the orchard. When these two individuals were alone in the orchard and they saw all the beautiful fruit, they decided to betray their task and eat all the fruit. Now, how did they do it? The lame man climbed on the shoulders of the blind man and told him where to go. And using the feet of the blind man and the eyes of the lame man, in partnership, they walked around the orchard, picked all the fruit, and they ate it all. When they were full and couldn't eat anymore, they were lying on the grass, stuffed with fruit. The king arrived in the orchard, saw all his fruit stolen, saw these two individuals, took a stick, was about to beat the lame man, when the lame man said to the king, but it couldn't have been me. You see, I can't walk. If it hadn't been for his legs, we never could have done this. So the king took a stick and he's about to beat the blind man, and the blind man said, it couldn't have been me, I couldn't see. Had it not been for his eyes, we never could have done this. Can't blame me. What did the king do? He picked up the lame man, put him back on the shoulders of the blind man, and beat them together. In other words, this is Gemara in Sanhedrin, in Perikalef, the Gemara is teaching us that the work of life is done as a partnership. That means the soul and the body operate as a team, and therefore the reward is given as a team. But there's always this partnership, this duality of souls and vessels. So let's examine it. Let's go back in history. Spend a few minutes examining the history of the relationship between the lights and the vessels, the souls and bodies. See if we can derive a principle that will answer our difficulty. And perhaps a message also that we can take home. You know, if we go back to Sarah Imenu. Let's begin there. Now, the Torah says that she had many names. And one of her names was Yiska. Yiska. What does that word mean? So the Midrash says, Ki akol sochin beyofia. The word Yiska, the root is soche. Ki akol sochin beyofia. Because everybody could see through her beauty. What does it mean to see through a woman's beauty? You know, in Hebrew, there are many words for seeing. For example, there's ro'eh, there's sofe, which means to see from a distance. There's mabit, which means to look. Mistakel, shul, which means to view. There are many, many words. But one of the words for seeing in Hebrew is socher. That's a very interesting word. It means to see through something. What other Hebrew root is based on the same Hebrew word based on the same root? Sukkah. What is a sukkah? Something you see through. The idea of a sukkah, sukkah is called a sukkah because of a schach. Sukkah means something soche, you see through the roof. That's why the roof should be transparent, at least the rain should come through if you not see the stars. Because the meaning of a sukkah is that you move from a solid structure that protects you into a flimsy structure that's transparent in order to see truly through, to see Hashem. In your own solid structure of a home, you don't see Hashem because you think the protection comes from the material. So you move into a sukkah. That's why the Zohar calls the sukkah tzeled mehem nusa, the shadow of faith. A woman, that's where you get to see the reality. Socher means to see through. What does it mean to see through a woman's beauty? And the answer is that a woman's beauty is a thing that can be presented in such a way that can bring you down, that can you look at the sensual beauty of a woman. is something that can be presented in a way that when a person looks at it, particularly a man, looks at it and it can make him think of the animal, or she can use that beauty in such a profound way, in such a refined way, that looking at it makes you think of an angel. That's tznius. Tznius, modesty, a woman's modesty doesn't mean that you have to be invisible or look terrible. Tznius doesn't mean walking around looking like something the cat dragged in. That's not tznius. Tznius means projecting yourself with such a refinement, with such a dignity, with such an elegance, that which could be fallen and sensual evokes a higher consciousness. That's tznius. And of course, you know, this is not a lecture on tznius in technical detail, but every woman knows that it's not the length of a sleeve, only the length of a skirt. It's a refined presentation. It's a walk, and it's a method of talking, and it's a presentation and a deportment. It's how much paint you put on your face. It's how you smell. Some women wear so much perfume, they walk into a room, half the men fall over anesthetized. No, that's not tznius. It's hard to put a finger on exactly the technicalities. But women know how to do this. Women can walk in the street in such a way that she takes all her spirituality and turns it into the good approximation of a horse. Or she can take all of that sensuality and project it in such a way that it stimulates an elevated consciousness. That's it. To see through her beauty, that means Sarah Suryamani was a woman of exquisite beauty. Beauty that could lead the Egyptians to murder. And she was able to carry that in such a way that if you saw her, you saw Hashem. Of course, if you're an Egyptian, there's no hope for you. If you're an Egyptian, you can look at anything and see the fallen. But anyone who has eyes to see would look at her and they would see through that beauty. That's this. Let's go back and examine this. Where did the problem begin? If you go back to the battle between the soul and the body, where did that battle begin? When Adam was created, and this you'll find in the writings of Dessler and many other places, when Adam was created, Adam HaRishon, he was created in such a way that the light in his vessel was so exquisitely represented that all you could see was the light. If you'd like, Dessler puts it like this, an exquisite description. How did Adam look? Again, we can't picture what he looked like. He was the size of the universe. The light that shone from his heels after death was greater than the sun. It's impossible for us to picture. He stretched from one end of the universe to the other. And our light lit above his head. But just a vague beginning of a description. Rav Dessler says that Adam looked the opposite of a human being now. When you look at a human being now, what do you see? You see only the body. Look at a human being, you can see only the body. If you look very carefully, you see a glow on the face, particularly of somebody who has become refined and has spent a lifetime of spiritual effort. That's called the ziva panim. By the way, that's why the face doesn't need garments. There's no shame in the face. But it's very hard to see. It's there, something flickering the moment before death, and it disappears the moment after death. It's very hard to see. Look at a human being, you see only the body, a very faint emanation of something, of a light. When Adam was created, he looked exactly the opposite. All you saw was the soul. And if you looked very carefully, you made the wispy outlines of a body. Imagine looking at a 1,000-watt electric bulb. You see the light. You look very hard, you can see a little bit of the glass. He looked exactly the opposite of the way we look now. And the reason is that his body was so perfect, because it was such a perfect vessel for the light inside, that it projected the light instead of obstructing it. And that's why it didn't need any clothing. Why do we need clothing? Why do we wear clothes? Let's think about it. Why do we wear garments? We wear garments why are we ashamed without clothes? Because when we are naked, we have a very painful schism in consciousness between an angelic inner being and a very animal outer being. The body that we inhabit is animal, given to contamination, to disintegration, smells bad, contains excrement, very humiliating. Human body, very animal. The evolutionists who see humans as animals, not surprising. But you know that inwardly is a soul, something angelic, something infinite. And the dichotomy between the two, that elevated soul that has an infinite component in an animal body, that tension needs to be hidden. And so when Adam sinned, what happened was, he took this diaphanous, ethereal, amazing body that shone the soul through, didn't need any clothing. Of course it didn't need clothes. What could have been more beautiful than a body like that? And he crushed it into its opposite, into its reverse. You know, think about it for a moment. When Adam was created, he was all spirit. That means when he said I, the first person I was only neshama. Where was the sensual animalistic? It was a serpent at a distance saying you. Second person. But the I, the inner consciousness of who I am, was only neshama, only spirit. And there was a distant, external, separate second person saying you, representing the sensual. After the sin, we became first person body. When we say I now, we mean the body. We mean the fallen, we mean the Yetzirah, the lecherous, the material, the childish, the lazy. And if there's a conscience, it speaks from elsewhere. You know, this is very easy to demonstrate. Very humiliating, but very easy. Which voice speaks? First person or second person when you're tempted sensually? Imagine you're facing something delicious that you'd like to taste, especially if you shouldn't. Delicious food. What inner voice speaks? I'd like to taste that. I'd like to taste that. And the conscience? No, you shouldn't. Very humiliating. Very humiliating. And the tone of voice is usually, I'd like to taste that. And the conscience is, excuse me. We have become the opposite. There was a reversal of role. Adam Arishan, Adam was created such that his neshama was all I. That was his consciousness. The external sensual was a very distant voice, separate from him. And now the I has become the childish and the sensual. And the conscience, if you're lucky, speaks from a distance. You know how the Gemara puts it? The Gemara says the Yetzirah, the animal, the lecherous, the material, is like a passerby in the street. Then he's like a beggar at the door. Then he's like a guest in your home. And then if you're lucky, you remain a guest. One of the great thinkers of this generation, of Moshe Shapiro, put it like this. He said, what's the right way to rob a bank? I mean, you have to imagine him saying this, sir. But what's the right way to rob a bank? You walk in with a gun and a motorcycle helmet. That's not a sensible way to rob a bank. The right way to rob a bank is you make an appointment with a manager, you walk into his office, you lock his door, you put a sock in his mouth, you tie him up, you lock him in the closet, you sit at his desk, you run the bank. That's the intelligent way to rob a bank. That is the way we have been dealt with by the Yetzirah. The Yetzirah has taken over. He's running the show and he's saying I. It's very humiliating. When we say I, when we say I, we mean the childish, the animalistic, the appetite. Where's the real I? Mumbling from inside a closet going, We've been hijacked by the lower self. That's why Chazal called the Yetzirah the Tzvoini. Tzvoini means the hidden one. What has it been hidden? There's no greater way of hiding a thing than putting it in front, in full view. That's why it's hidden. It's hidden so intensely that you think he's you. So when Adam was created, he was all spirit, and the vessel was totally loyal. The body projected the neshama so perfectly it didn't need any clothing. What could have been sillier than clothes? But after that crash, the solution became clothing. And the solution is amazing. When Adam sinned initially and he saw his shame, he tried to cover a small area of his body, the most shameful. And Hashem said, I'm going to teach you an amazing spiritual lesson. From now on in the world, the problem must become the solution. Clothes now must not hide you, they must reveal your dignity. And Hashem sewed him garments of dignity. By the way, you know what's interesting, amazing? The Talmud says that before Adam sinned, he was clothed in garments of light. Kosmos Or, Aleph Vav Resh. After the sin, he became clothed in garments of Ayin Vav Resh. Or, skin. You know that in Hebrew, when you take a word with an aleph and you transpose it and spell the same word with an ayin, you will see a transition from a spiritual to a physical thing. Amazing thing, do this as a homework exercise. Make a long list of words that begin with an aleph, rewrite them again with an ayin, and you'll see a transition from a spiritual to a physical thing, from a light to a heavy thing. Easy to show this. I mean, the word ayin, for example, aleph yud nun ayin, means it's not revealed. When you spell it ayin, the eye, the organ that does reveal. Ma'ayan, this word in Hebrew, ayin, means a wellspring when the hidden water under the ground becomes visible. First he was clothed in garments of aleph vavresh, light. And after the sin he became clothed in garments of ayin vavresh, skin. In Hebrew, ayin vav resh spells or skin, and also iver, blind. First he was clothed in garments of reveal, and now we are clothed in garments of hide. By the way, the white verse is called a hide in English. It's called a thick hide. Where did they get that from? Because or skin in Hebrew means hide. And therefore the solution became, now the inner cannot be seen from the outer. Now you look at the outer, you see the outer. You look for the angelic, you see the animal. And the solution becomes beggared. A beggared means that you, when a king wears royal garments, the garments hide the king, but they reveal his royalty. That's why we're so fussed about dignified clothing in Torah. The Gemara says, my clothes are my honor, my dignity. But the problem is, when you wear garments, it's another layer of hiding, and now, you know, the word beggar in Hebrew means a garment, and it also means treachery. Treachery. Beggared, boged is a traitor. You know, the old English word for a traitor was a turncoat. So beggared means treachery. By the way, an outer garment in Hebrew is called a me'il. Me'il, a coat. It also means treachery. Me'ilah means to take a sanctified inner thing and bring it out to the profane. Because a garment, that's what a garment does. You know, in the deep Torah sources, it's pointed out that the word beggared is an amazing word. You know that the alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet, begins with an aleph. Aleph is always the letter of spirit. Right? Like we said, when it becomes an ayin, it changes. But an aleph is always the letter, it's a soundless letter, it means one. Aleph always means the connection between the spiritual and the physical. What is an aleph? It's two yuds and a vav. Yud, the 10 spirits, the 10 mystical emanations coming down from the higher world as they're reflected in this world, joined by the letter that means connection. That's what an aleph is. It's the connection between higher and lower worlds. Two tens and a vav, 26, Hashem's name. And Aleph says it all. Aleph is the letter of the soul. And the next three letters in Hebrew, Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet, Beged. First the soul, and then the garment of the soul as you move into the world. With the clothing, body initially, then the clothes. And that's what happened. Adam and Chava were created in such a way that they were naked. There was no possibility of shame. And then the world was cast into this disparity where the body speaks for itself instead of demonstrating the soul. And the solution is now to hide the body in a way that reveals its dignity. And that's the beginning of tzniut. Of this function of modesty that is a revealing of dignity in a method of covering. And as that process moves on through history, the process gets worse. The initial point of this was when Adam sinned and made the body dominant, and the solution became a projection of the body in the correct fashion. As you move through history, this problem gets worse and worse and worse. And there's a watershed moment in history. Perhaps we'll finish with this, to understand, is that if you take the span of history, if you call 6,000 years, imagine the creation of the world, and as we march on through history to the year 6,000, and we're here someplace, we're 5,770, we have the hindsight, the benefit of seeing the whole of Torah's predictions of history having come true. And there are many ways to divide the 6,000 years, but the Gemara says one fascinating and essential understanding is this. If you go back 2,350 years, you get back to a watershed moment in history, and that's when prophecy ended. Prophecy, miracles, the revealed, what we call Gilui Panim, Hashem revealing himself, that ended then. From the beginning of history until then, Hashem revealed himself openly in the world. Prophecy, the Rambam says, miracles took place, you needed a prophet for every miracle. Hashem was revealed openly in the world. And then the lights faded, the lights went out. 2,350 years ago, Purim, Esther. Esther means to hide. After Esther's Hanukkah, and then the lights are out completely. And we are deep in the generations of darkness, what's called Hester Panim. It's not difficult to see. Well, what happened with Esther? Esther means the one who hides. And Esther is a woman whose beauty is hidden. What was Esther's beauty? The Gemara says she wasn't beautiful. Previously you have women in Torah, exquisite beauty. And then you get to a woman in Torah who's not beautiful at all. The mystery is how the king was attracted to her. The Gemara says she had a green face. She was a married woman. Can you imagine? There's a midrash someplace that says she was 75 years old. You understand? This is the Persian Empire. The king assembles young girls. Can you imagine the exquisite beauty of those girls? And they pickled them in perfumes and 6 months of, you know, soaking, pickling in musks and perfumes. It's enough to drive a feminist up the wall. And among these exquisite beauties from the entire Persian Empire, there's this Jewish woman whose much older, with a green face, who's married. We're talking about a different sort of beauty. Here, beauty goes into hiding. Here, we're moving into the generations where beauty is much more intensely hidden. And of course, prophecy ends and miracles end. Generation of Esther, the Megillah, Hashem's name is not mentioned. The miracle is a hidden type of a miracle. Yes, there's a Megillah, but it hides. And the next thing that happens in Jewish history is Hanukkah, and there's nothing written about Hanukkah at all. Not even a Mishnah, nothing at all. No revelation, no miracle. The light of the oil is a very different type of miracle. That light of the oil burning for 8 days had nothing to do with saving the Jewish people. It was very private, it was in the temple, only the Gaonim saw it. It's much more like the miracles that occur in the time of Talmud, which are manipulations of the natural. Tonight's not the time to go into that. But it's a generation of hiddenness, the light fades, and now we move into a generation of tremendous darkness. And here we come to the extreme need for tzniut. Because in these early generations, when the point of origin, the body couldn't have been more beautiful. The praise of the body was the praise of the soul. The more beautiful and naked the body was, the more projected its inner content. And then there was a time when a beautiful content needed a beautiful vessel. And a beautiful painting needed a beautiful frame. But as we move through history, initially the crash occurred when Adam Rishon broke that relationship into its distorted version, and that marches on through history getting worse and worse. And the watershed moment is when you reach Hanukkah, Purim, and Hashem steps back from the world, and now there's nothing to be seen. And now the presentation of the body becomes so problematic that we move into the phase where Meshulam and Hananya lives, and the beautiful people of Yerushalayim, the beautiful people of Jewish history, that no longer is an asset. It's too dangerous. There's too much danger now when the spiritual content is no longer to be seen. You see only the content. Previously, you need a beautiful frame for a beautiful painting. Now you need a very simple frame. Previously, you need gold and silver vessels. What could make more sense? Because the vessel, the vehicle, served only the content. And as you march on through history, you get deeper and deeper into the phase where the vessel is only problematic. And therefore, our great ordeal now is an ordeal of sneers. And therefore, we now live in a generation where we need a tremendous dose of modesty and hiddenness, and we live in a world where exactly the opposite is present. And the dignity, the opportunity that we have as Jews, men as well as women, is to present ourselves with such a dignity, with such a refinement, that the most fallen aspect of the human, the nakedness, the animal nakedness of the body, and the fallen sensual nature of the human being, can be elevated in such a refined fashion that when you look at a human being, instead of seeing an animal, you see an angel.